Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Very pleased to be back with you this week. Coming up on today's program, we've got Senior Voices. Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac. And in our series, County Lines, retired Kenyon College professor and former director of Kenyon's Rural Life Center, Howard Sachs, reflects on the definition of rural character. Up first, Lori Arion knows about addiction. Arion is the founder and executive director of Families of Addicts, an organization dedicated to helping families who are on the front lines of the current opioid crisis. She is also a certified Ohio Peer Recovery Supporter. PRS is a program of the Ohio Mental Health and Addiction Services. The program is a convention of peer specialists, recovery coaches, and peer supporters. As Arion tells us in this interview, her education and experience with addiction goes much deeper.
I started FOA in October of 2013, really, as, I really didn't think it through very much, but I have 12 years of my own recovery now. And my daughter, when I found out that my daughter was using heroin, it was an animal of a different color. And the things that had worked for me weren't really working for her. And all of the things that us families experience, the frustration, the worry, the misunderstanding, and all of that was what was happening to me. And I thought, with my recovery and still being so mystified, I started thinking about all the other families that didn't know anything. And I imagined the guy meeting his neighbor outside. One neighbor says, "Hey, how you doing?" The other guy says, "I'm doing great," but he's really going to Lowe's to get a new lawnmower. And he's not disclosing to his neighbor that his son stole his lawnmower because he's a drug addict. Because we don't raise our kids to be addicts. We do everything we can to guide our kids and have them, you know, and so how does this happen? And so I wanted to educate families, and I wanted to educate them using people in recovery or people who are looking for recovery, because even if they're not there yet, they still can help educate us on why they do what they do and how we can best support them during any of the times when they're either actively using or changing to be motivated to get help or actually in recovery. And it's every path along the way is difficult for everyone.
I think there are very few families untouched by the current crisis that's taking place today. And you mentioned that even going through your own recovery, that you were shocked to find out that your daughter was had experimented or was using heroin. Can you talk a little bit about why that was so shocking for you?
Sure. Well, number one, she was terrified of needles. I would have to call up our medical provider and warn them when they would be taking blood that she was going to go ballistic. So the fact that she was so afraid of needles and then she was using them, I really could not even understand that at all. I knew she was using drugs, but I think for us a little bit older folks, back in our day, you know, using heroin was something that those people did over there. And we didn't do that. There was some type of fear that somehow we had that's not there today. You know, and so our perspective on it is like, oh my God, wow, you know, how did this happen? And just way more prevalent today with not that fear that we had. And so as a result, what FOA turned into was initially a support group. And we started our first meeting November 6th, 2013. So there wasn't a whole lot of time. Like, I didn't develop a curriculum or anything. This was really all about people helping people. And, you know, so what I say now is we make the roller coaster shorter and smoother, but you're not getting off. And there's all different spots on that roller coaster, and they change. Nothing is ever really exactly the same. The relapse last time isn't the same as the relapse this time. And, you know, so there's always someone who's been where you're headed that can help you with that. But then shortly after I started the weekly meetings, I saw the Anonymous People movie. And we had the pleasure of having Greg Williams, who made that movie, come visit us. And that was just, like, huge because of that movie, that's where we started speaking out and not being anonymous and letting other families know that we're there for them and letting the cameras into our meetings and really having the people that are attending not mind, understanding that we need to let other families know that they're not alone and that we're eliminating that stigma associated with us families. We're stigmatized horribly as well as parents, and the advice we get is really crazy, and it's like people that haven't walked in our shoes to deliver judgments and what we should be doing is crazy, because until you experience it, you'll never know what you would do, you know. So that's how we went from support and advocacy, and that's why we have the rally every year, and that's why you see us on the news and in the paper and et cetera, because we're just not, you know, we're so tactful, we have so much integrity, and we do it in a very nice way. So it's not like we're angry and we're pushing stuff on people, but that some advocacy agencies, and anger produces advocacy, that's true, but we don't, we're just a very, like I said, we're very polite about how we do things.
Before we talk a little bit more about the work you're doing, you mentioned that for previous generations like ours, that heroin was really the scariest thing mm-hmm. on taking place on the block, and you rarely saw it. Today, there's a lot of talk about the stigma that goes with opioid use mm-hmm. and drug abuse. Do you think you can go too far with removing the stigma, or do you think things are on the right path with kind of how the social message is getting out?
Things are different, I believe. Some people, some listeners may not agree, but I believe that the explosion of the painkillers changed the whole dynamic of opioid addiction. And as a result, there are so many people that got addicted to opiates by being prescribed pain medication after an injury that never saw it coming or never did anything, didn't hang around with the wrong crowds and all of that stuff and didn't know what was happening. So number one, in that case, I don't think that was happening. I mean, how many years ago? 25 years? How old am I? I'm 58. So, you know, that's a lot of years ago when I was 16, 17, 18, 20, early 20s. So I feel like that has changed it a lot. And so in that respect, someone who accidentally gets addicted because no one told them that this could happen shouldn't be stigmatized in any way. Then it needs to be treated as a chronic illness that has no cure, but it has a solution. That's what I always say, and that's a quote out of that movie. And so I do feel like treatment needs to be available when you want it, because there's a small window of time when you're ready. So treatment needs to be available when people are ready. However, this really truly is the kind of illness where you have to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. You have to reach a point. And even if our loved ones reach that point, it doesn't always mean that they're able to follow through. And that doesn't mean that they didn't mean it or anything like that. And that's the whole point of getting yourself educated, is just because they started to access help and weren't able to make the mark doesn't mean that they really weren't trying or really weren't dedicated. But opiates is so powerful and so gripping and takes over all of the I think they call them the saline senses or something, like our motivators to keep ourselves alive, you know, food, breathing, all of that. And opiates goes right above all of that. And so when you're not able to think and make decisions based on your safety and your health, that's how all of this happens. And so it's a fine line. You know, in a lot of respects, we need to let them reach that point. If we don't let them reach that point, then they may not ever get there. And that point and that process is different for every family and every person and every different relapse or scenario. And that's what it's telling you. It's never exactly the same. You know, what I do today is different than what I did 5-6 years ago.
And just briefly summarize for me, you've referenced the movie Anonymous, documentary film?
Mm-hmm. The Anonymous People movie, yeah. That I saw really early on, and it's about the 23 million people in long-term recovery that aren't saying anything. So we have our recovery groups that we attend, 12-step, you know, faith-based, whatever it may be, that's working, but we're not coming out of those groups and saying something. Now, since I started this 5 years ago, there's lots of people talking. But I truly believe 5 years ago, we were one of the few people that was out there talking about it freely. And I want to say joyfully, but talking about it in a way that, hey, just because our loved ones have this illness doesn't mean that we need to be sucked into it and have a horrible life too. Guess what? People can and do recover. And guess what? Families can and do recover also. And so that's kind of our message, is that, you know, celebrating those that are making it. I mean, there are so many that we're losing. And there needs to be some solution action-based activities that are going on. Or as a community and as a nation, we will get into a mode of depression that we're never going to get out of this. And so that's where we just give tons of hope and love to everyone around us that people can do recovery. And that could be you or your loved one also.
And moving back to some of the work that you're doing, you do have a Families of Addiction Rally for Recovery coming up. Let's talk about that.
We do, August 26th. So it's under 2 weeks away. We're, getting all of our final pieces in place. And this is our fifth one. We are expecting at least 3,000 people to show up. We've got a lot of media coverage, and also WYSO, thank you for your sponsorship on that.
Sure.
So reaching a lot more people, and it's really just 3 hours. It's short 3 hours, a couple reasons. We don't like our vendors to be out on Sunday all day, and because as a vendor I know what that feels like. And then also we like to capture what we call the big picture, and the big picture is going to happen at about 4:30 this year. We do a really quick sobriety countdown, so anyone who has any length of sobriety will be called up by that length to the front of the stage, in front, on the square. And then we snap a picture of those people in recovery, and then we ask all of anyone else who's been touched by addiction to enter in the picture. And then it's amazing to see the difference between our people in recovery and everyone who's affected. And a lot of times those others, are not who our funds and our programs are helping. A lot of our funding and programs is helping people access recovery, which we need. I'm not going to say we don't. But I call us the forgotten family sometimes, because, families can be, not always, but can be, especially the ones that never saw it coming, the most stable part of the equation. And without educating and embracing them like we do, we're missing the point that they could actually be a great support system. And so that's the picture that gets published with everybody. And people love to be in the picture, and they get depressed when they're not in it. And even though you can't see a face, they'll go, "I'm right there." So people are really proud to be representing our community in this faith and hope and positive way. And so that's a really big thing. We do a eco-friendly balloon launch, which is really, really impactful. Josh is going to do about a 30-second spiel on what the balloon launch did for him the first time he saw it, which I never even realized how people were impacted by it. And that's going to happen right after the big picture. And we've got over 50 resources this year on the square. We like to keep it to 50, but we just had so many that wanted to be there, and I thought it was important that they were. So we're doubling up on the ones, on some of the standard resources that aren't sponsors. So we have a total of actually 63 now. And we have a map that says exactly how to maneuver through those resources, so that if you only want to hit one or two, they're 4 and 10, I'm going to go here and here. So you don't spend a whole lot of time trying to find what you're looking for. It's all going to be mapped out by number, by resource, where they're at. And so, even if people don't want to identify and don't want to get excited about recovery, at least go see the resources if you have a loved one or yourself who is suffering with this, because it is all going to be laid out for you right there. So the resource is another thing. Rising Life Band is awesome. They're a faith-based band that's got great melodies, great songs, great messages. And although we're not a faith-based organization, we love faith-based. That's one of the pathways to peace. And so they're just a really, really great band and people. Food trucks, what else? TapSnap, which is digital photos that'll be shared on social media. A raffle, we got over $2,500 in raffle. You just can't lose. And then I'm just going to say, don't forget to check out our birthday blessings bear. It's going to be a tent, and it's based on a donation, but it's the cutest little FOA bear. And all of the dollars from that will go to our birthday blessings hardship fund, which we use to directly help people when they reach out and they have a barrier and they just need a little bit of dollars to pay a fine or get a bus pass. We've gone from bus passes to beds, help people with their needs. And so 100% of that profit will go to our birthday blessings fund. Like I said, the bear is really, really cute.
The FOA Rally for Recovery is August 26th. It runs from 3 to 6 p.m.
Yep.
And takes place on Courthouse Square in downtown Dayton. That's at 3rd and Main Streets, right downtown. And there's some important training taking place before and after the rally.
Yes.
That I think people want to know about.
Yes. Project Dawn and Samaritan have partnered with us to provide Narcan training before and after. So that's going to be 2 to 3. And then again, it's 6 to 7. That's going to be held in the collaboratory office, which I call the CVS corridor, which is between KeyBank and CVS. In there, we're going to have people with signs that say Narcan training, so you can easily find it. And I really suggest that you register on our website, foafamilies.org. You'll see the Narcan training drop down from the rally. And it's just a very simple form to get you on our list. That way we know how many people to accommodate.
Great. And people can get more information at foafamilies.org. We've been speaking with Lori Arion. She is the founder and executive director of Families of Addicts. Lori, thanks so much for your time and the information you've given us today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this. I mean, it's just really, really important that our communities get educated and know that they're not alone and know that there is help out there.
Thank you. And again, the FOA Rally for Recovery takes place August 26th on Courthouse Square in downtown Dayton. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Today on County Lines, we bring you a commentary by retired Kenyon College professor and former director of Kenyon's Rural Life Center, Howard Sachs, looking out over the rolling farm fields from the front porch of his 94-acre farm in Gambier, located in Knox County. Howard reflects on what the definition of rural character is and what it means to him.
My family operates a farm in Knox County, some 50 miles outside the city limits of Columbus, Ohio. Over the past few decades, urban sprawl has come our way, transforming the rural landscape and small villages into suburban developments and commercial strips. Driving past the miles of decorative fencing surrounding a gated community, my wife Judy sighs, "So much fence, so little livestock." The rural character of this county is still visible all around me. I see it driving down township roads surrounded by open green landscapes, rolling fields and pastures that are punctuated by the occasional farmhouse and clusters of outbuildings. I hear it sitting on the front porch of my farmhouse at night, surrounded by silence and the occasional sounds of nature beneath the heavy darkness of a starry evening sky. But along the next road west of our place, the fields have been split into 5-acre lots, and the lights from modular homes and starter mansions now dim the night skies. The new influx of residents to this rural community like the idea of living in the country, but don't care much for the sense of farm life or the sounds of machinery during harvest time that are a practical part of living in the country. In the face of this transformative change, local citizens convened a public dialogue about the future of our community. The primary goal was to preserve the rural character of our county. But what is rural character? For most Americans, rural means little more than the absence of what we associate with urban life, from cultural amenities to social diversity. The federal government defines rural simply as low population density. But these definitions fail to capture the distinctive elements that constitute a rural way of life. Much of Knox County's economy still relies on agriculture. The grain silo at the Farmers Co-op remains the tallest building in the county seat. Implement dealers still sell and repair farm equipment like tractors, hay elevators, and brush hogs. The county's rural heritage embodies a distinctive set of cultural values: neighborliness, hard work, and independence. Rural character also denotes a certain kind of sociability, an intimacy rooted in connection to place. Old-time farmers speak of knowing the inside of everyone else's kitchens a generation ago, when neighbors would take dinner together as they moved from farm to farm in collective labor to bring in the harvest. Today, neighbors still gather at the Grange Hall, but its members, like the overall farming population, is aging, and Grange membership is in rapid decline. In simple terms, rural character means seeing the night sky, working the land, knowing your neighbors, and valuing community. We've lost much of this in modern society, at great cost to our individual and collective well-being. Today, longtime residents don't quite trust newcomers who won't bother to get to know their neighbors and treat the area as a bedroom community or weekend retreat. In response, the new residents often find their older neighbors a bit standoffish. My daughter plans to take over our farm in a few years, and I worry that she won't have the same opportunities as past generations, or be able to experience the rural character of our community the way we have, which has given us so much peace through connection to the land and to our neighbors. I'm Howard Sachs, former professor at Kenyon College and former director of the Rural Life Center. I also farm with my wife here in Gambier, Ohio.
County Lines is made possible by a grant from the Ohio Humanities. For Daytonians of a certain age, the memories of the city's glory days as a post-World War II manufacturing center are vivid. Lewis Eckert started working at Delco Products in the 1970s while still a student at Patterson Co-op High School in Dayton, and he attended the General Motors Institute of Technology in Flint, Michigan. He recalled his GM career in this Senior Voices interview with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Carol Jackson.
When I was a high school co-op, I started working at Delco Products over on First Street. And then when I went to General Motors Institute, I continued working with Delco Products through that period. My dad also worked at Delco Products, as well as three of my uncles. We started out in the mailroom. And with that assignment, then you covered all the different factory areas and office areas. So I got to know all of the facilities very well. And then when I went on into GMI and my assignments with that, where you had to work within different aspects or divisions of the company, and then when I went on into mechanical engineering, I already had a good basis for how to move through the factory and what the different work segments, you know, like accounting or sales or how they would all interact. And as such, then that made it a little bit easier for me to adjust to get into those kind of careers. Mm-hmm. I thought it really worked out very well for me, you know, with my early start. So I was able to actually retire at a fairly early age.
Yeah. Any complaints about that time at all?
I remember when we had a Delco strike, and my father was off work for that time frame. Mm-hmm. I remember crossing picket lines when I was working because of some of the strikes that were going. Now, none of those were more than a day or two while I was working. But still you had the aspect of just how union and management interacted with each other and how that friction sometimes would carry over into the job and negatively impact the product. And I found that General Motors or Delco, it's, you know, at the time when I started, General Motors was extremely powerful. As time went, we saw where the labor relations and the union aspect and then the foreign development, the competition, impacted it in a negative format. It, you know, that aspect essentially led to the deterioration of Delco and of General Motors as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I'm very disappointed that General Motors has gotten so weak. I no longer feel like General Motors is an American company. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's essentially an Italian company now. I'm glad to see things beginning to bounce back. I think we're in a good direction now. I think the city council and I think the mayor is moving things in a good direction. But we certainly went through a very deep period there, and I think the time when NCR left was the bottom. The good interaction between the education areas and Wright-Patt is really helping to bring a rebirth of some of the industry in the area. I think Dayton history and Carillon Park has done a good thing or aspect for me to look at things as the broader picture. As a volunteer at the park, we speak to a lot of people from all over the world and all over the U.S. Some other cities have rebounded a little faster than Dayton in how they've responded from the loss of manufacturing and moved on. And I think Dayton is moving in that right direction now.
Lewis Eckert was raised in the region, now identified as Old North Dayton. His vast knowledge of Dayton history is put to good use in his role as a volunteer at Carillon Park. He was interviewed for Senior Voices by Carol Jackson. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Dave Barber. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. And the series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of late summer. It's the second week of the Blackberry Jam Moon and the first week of the Sun in Virgo. When I look back and try to understand what happened the other day, I reach for impressions and feelings that, in recollection, become the story. Although I had a number of appointments and other things I had to do, I only remember now that the breeze was cool and the sun was clear and hot throughout the afternoon. And I remember that I saw so many butterflies, many cabbage white butterflies spinning in love randori above the red and orange and yellow zinnias. And tiny blue butterflies, azures, fluttered down into the faded bee balm. As I stood thinking about the summer, a hackberry brown, a plain and medium-sized butterfly, came and bumped me on the back of my head, and then on my shoulder, and then it sat on my forearm. She had emerged, perhaps, to tend the fallen peaches near my huge hackberry tree. I greeted her as the spirit of a person whose birthday was that day and who had died a few years ago this month. Well, then I talked with a giant swallowtail near sunflowers, and then with four yellow tiger swallowtails, and then with a black swallowtail, and with another hackberry brown. And as I stood in conversation, a hummingbird moth came and went, its wings humming like a hive of bees, and then small golden fold-winged skipper butterflies played in the ferns by my side, and more cabbage whites chased each other all across the length of the garden. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of late summer. In the meantime, talk to any butterfly that you happen to see and tell them the story of your day. Poor Will's Almanac for 2019 is now available. You can order your copy from Amazon.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Chris Smithers, one of the absolute best singer-songwriters in the world, says the Associated Press, and he's playing our community concert. It's free and open to the public, a chance to gather the YSO musical family and celebrate songcraft and musicianship of the highest order. Chris Smithers at the YSO Community Concert, presented by Wagner Subaru, Sunday, September 9th at Riverscape Metro Park in downtown Dayton. Details at yso.org. Bring a chair. See you there.
He's almost shade down by the river. Feels the breath.